salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to the latest episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg and Vicki Nichols Goldstein's again traveling, but it's always a pleasure to welcome back Natasha Benjamin. Hi, Natasha.
Hi, David.
Today, we're talking with Kay Toniolo of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In 24 years with the service, she's been a park ranger, a superintendent of the Pacific Remote Islands National Marine Monument, and we're going to have to get back and see what that's all about. She's now project leader for Coastal Delaware's National Wildlife Refuges, Coastal Wonders along Delaware's shoreline. Recently, I got to visit Prime Hook Refuge, where Kate leads a more than decade-long, multi-million-dollar restoration effort following the area's devastation by 2012's Hurricane Sandy. We'll get into that and more, but first, blue news you can use. So, Natasha, what's your blue news? I heard you just returned from Mexico.
I did. I was lucky enough to go down and do some surfing in warm water, which is always a nice change after being in Northern California, frigid waters that require a very thick wetsuit. So it was nice, a nice change, little Mexican vacation.
Burr, you protect what you love even when it's freezing cold. Less thrilling is the news from NOAA that we've now entered the fourth global coral bleaching event tied to warming ocean temperatures that hit a new record last year. I've covered coral bleaching since 1998, and it's ugly. I've seen coral reefs turn wet and cake white before dying from heat stress. But this is the largest event by far, already impacting over half the world's coral reefs and growing 1% a week. So we've had the Coral Restoration Foundation on the show talking about their efforts to restore corals in a warming ocean. But the challenge is really, can we do restoration at scale? Well, also getting off the fossil fuels that are driving catastrophic climate change. The 10,000-acre Prime Hook Refuge that I visited suggests coastal restoration and protection is possible. And before we talk about the work you're doing on that, Kate, maybe you can do what we always do on the show, which is talk about what your first, earliest connection was with the ocean.
Oh, gosh. Well, so I grew up, first and foremost, thank you for having me today. I'm really excited to chat with you both. But I grew up on the coast of Massachusetts. From the time I was 3 years old till I was 18, we spent every summer at Salisbury Beach. And then for 3 years, we lived there year round. And one of my earliest memories of the ocean was where I used to shout, "Mommy, I'm afraid of the whales." And my mom would be like, "What, Kate, what are you talking about? There are whales in the ocean, but there's no whales right here." And I'm like, "No, see right there, I'm afraid of the whales." And it was the waves. So I was confusing whales with waves. That was probably age three, the only time I was afraid of the ocean of any kind, because I pretty much spent my entire childhood in the 80s just on the beach all day long, keeping little sandpail aquariums. So unfortunately, I did have a little bit of a localized impact on the population there. But
snails and sea stars?
Yeah, sea stars very much. They were the earliest to die. They would die, like if you collected them, they'd be dead by that night. They were not bucket friendly. I grew up at the ocean. The beach was my nature. It was my full experience into it. And it's what I ultimately wanted to protect.
So, and is that what you went to study in college or after high
school? Yeah, well, I started out as an English major. First and foremost, I wanted to be a movie star. But then the birth of my activism really started when I was 12, when I had heard from my landlord at the beach that there was a company planning to come in and pump pollutants into the ocean. And I got really upset and didn't understand why anyone would want to trash the beach. It was my favorite place in the world. And I coordinated, there was going to be a protest march the next day, and I coordinated all my little neighborhood friends to make a big sign on an old bedsheet that said, "Save our beaches, don't waste our future." We all put our names and ages on it. And then I convinced a grown-up friend of the family to carry the sign with me down the beach the next day. And it was from that moment on that like my environmentalism was kind of born and had always been something that I was really passionate about. So I knew I wanted to, when I was looking at jobs and looking what I wanted to do in life, I really wanted to work for the government because I wanted to be in the building making decisions and not outside the building yelling at it. So it was like, where could I have the biggest impact? And I always felt like, well, if I was in the place where they're making the laws and they're doing that kind of thing, that's what I want to be doing. So UMass is right next to the regional office for Fish and Wildlife. As I started looking at different government agencies, I really was interested in fish and wildlife science orientation. You know, it's basically everybody who's involved in the agency usually has a really strong science background. So I knew that that's really kind of was my dream of where I wanted to work.
And nice. And you went down to Maryland. What were your first jobs and how do you move through that process?
So my very first job was as an outdoor recreation planner. I was doing mostly visitor services work. So working with the public, leading special events, doing educational programs for kids, communications. It's something, again, part of my once wanting to be a movie star persona. I really enjoy communicating and talking with folks. So I was able to utilize some of those skills there. And then from there, I went to Parker River National Wildlife Refuge, which is on the coast of Massachusetts, actually just a few miles south of where I grew up. So that was very much a homecoming for me. And I was there and I led the visitor services program there. So kind of set that up and was a supervisory park ranger. And then from there, I went to our regional office back in Western Mass. And I was the regional visitor services coordinator for about 7 years. And at that point, I was like, as much as I love visitor services and working with visitors, I really wanted to kind of take a leap into management, into refuge management. And I ended up getting a job in Hawaii as a refuge manager, a deputy refuge manager, deputy superintendent for the largest unit of the refuge system, which is Papahana Mokuakea Marine National Monument. It's 587,000 square miles of ocean and with islands at the center of it. So got to be doing that on a big scale in an ocean that I was not as familiar with. I was certainly more familiar with the Atlantic than I was the Pacific. You know, one of the things that happened while I was in that job, Hurricane Walaka came and wiped out Turn Island at French Frigate Shoals. It was a really intense, very upsetting event that happened. And that's where 95% of the Hawaiian green sea turtles in the world nested, was on East Island and French Frigate Shoals. And also wiped out the coral reef there during that hurricane. It was a very intense hurricane that spun up suddenly. You know, we lost islands in real time. You know, when you talk about climate change and seeing things and how they're affecting the ocean, you know, some of the things that we were thinking about is, okay, we know we're going to lose some of these islands. How do we protect these species that they exist nowhere else in the world?
Your monk seals.
Yeah, or Laysan finch, you know, they're endemic to Laysan Island. You know, Laysan Island disappears, where do the finches go? That's an extinction right there. So was in that job for a couple of years before becoming the manager or superintendent of the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument. So, which is slightly smaller, only, you know, 490,000 square miles versus, you know, the 580.
Well, tell us about getting out to these places. I mean, 70% of U.S. corals are in the Papahana Mokuakea and Palmyra and other places that are thought of as our images of kind of South Pacific paradises. What was it like getting out there and seeing it?
So a lot of the islands are very difficult to get to. In the Pacific Remotes, I managed to not go to four of my islands in the time that I worked there. I was only able to get to three of them out of the seven. And because a lot of them, you know, Howland and Baker islands, which are near the equator, would have been an 8-day boat ride from Honolulu, but got to Midway a few times because they have a runway there. So I was able to take a plane. Same thing with Palmyra, was able to get there a few times. And then I was able to get on a special flight to Johnston when we were getting a crew off of there. We had crews on Johnston working on eradicating yellow crazy ant, which was it's an ant that sprays formic acid into the eyes and beaks of birds and can deform them or outright kill them. And we spent 11 years, $6 million eradicating that ant, and we were successful. It was the first time an ant had ever been eradicated in such a large area. So I got to go there for a short period of time as
so
well.
So you stomped out those invasives. I'll have to send you a copy of my article, Rat Killers in Paradise. So what brought you from the far reaches of the Pacific back to President Biden's home beaches of Delaware?
So, you know, again, growing up on the East Coast, it's, I have a lot of family here. I have aging in-laws, and, you know, Hawaii is an absolutely amazing place. I love it. I miss it every day. I hopefully will someday get back there. But, this time in my life, it was time for a move. You know, when I was thinking about the next job I wanted and kind of where in the world I wanted to be or where in the United States I wanted to be somewhere rural, but close to a big city, with good schools and good cost of living and close to the beach, but maybe not right at the beach. And man, Delaware seriously checked every single one of those boxes. So when this job came up, I was really excited about it. And this manager job, you know, we are building two brand new visitor centers. I'm in one right now. So it was really able to play on some of my strengths as a former visitor services manager. And then also as a refuge manager.
I know David was fortunate enough to come visit the Wildlife Refuge. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like there for someone who's never been there and the work that you're doing on restoration?
Sure. So Prime Hook, we have two refuges in the state of Delaware, Bombay Hook National Wildlife Refuge, which is kind of towards the center of the state, and then Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge, which is where David came in the southern portion of the state. Both refuges are on the bay. So they're both part of the Delaware Bay ecosystem. And Bombay Hook, you know, it's about 16,000 acres, a lot of salt marsh, a lot of salt marsh at both refuges. Prime Hook, though, also has dune habitats, which you don't really find as much up at Bombay Hook. Both refuges are very highly visited by bird watchers and photographers in particular, and then to a lesser extent by fishers and hunters and people doing environmental education and interpretation. But Prime Hook, you know, there's a very cool dune ecosystem there and dune habitat, but essentially there had been behind that dune ecosystem initially had been some freshwater impoundments. So the Fish and Wildlife Service, good or bad, and the refuge system, and we did a lot of building impoundments in places. We have several impoundments here at Bombay Hook as well. And basically an impoundment is just a freshwater marsh and freshwater body. And they're usually really great habitat for a lot of wildlife. But sometimes where they had been placed in the past, you know, was based on the best science available at the time. They didn't necessarily work in the long term. So the impoundments that had been at Prime Hook were where natural salt marsh would have been. And over time, one of the things we didn't realize was happening in the impoundments is that the peat layer and the land underneath them was really disappearing. It was collapsing. And then we also had several nor'easters that started to create breaches in the dune habitat. And then Hurricane Sandy came along and kind of pushed it all in, basically brought the bay in, and there wasn't really a marsh behind it to absorb that. So there was a lot of flooding that would happen in the community. You know, I wasn't here during this time, but, you know, the folks who were here at that time had been really trying to find ways, you know, how can we make this a better, more resilient ecosystem? What can we do? And, you know, had already been thinking about some of that stuff prior to Hurricane Sandy happening. So they already kind of had a plan in mind of how to do the restoration. And then we were able to get $38 million in Hurricane Sandy funding to do basically one of the biggest coastal ecosystem restorations that's ever happened on the East Coast.
Wow. So before we get into that, just so the impoundments in the past, a lot of tidal flows that made salt marshes were cut off and turned into freshwater marshes, which are good for like hunting ducks. They draw ducks and other critters, but not long-term sustainable as we get more extreme weather events and more intense hurricanes. Sandy was a example of that, unexpected right. on scale and ferocity. Sort of took out everything from the shoreline side back into what had been freshwater marsh. And there's also a town there, and they were devastated. And And now what was done, you were saying, the restoration got sort of supercharged by the devastation.
They restored 23 miles of former tidal channels, tidal flow, you know, basically did a lot of modeling to figure out, okay, what did this system used to look like and how can we build a resilient salt marsh within the system? And, you know, so they did a lot of dredge work and spraying, you know, side casting of mud substrate, and then also did a lot of, you know, aerial seeding of the salt marsh to basically rebuild that area back. And then also rebuilt the dunes from dredge spoil, I believe, within the bay, and, you know, pumped, you know, 1 million cubic yards of sand, I believe, to rebuild the dune ecosystem. And it was funny, before the dunes were even done, the plovers were already coming to check it out. The piping plovers were like, yes.
So endangered shorebird.
Yes. They're federally threatened, state endangered. And they're doing relatively poorly in the Southern Recovery Unit, which Delaware is part of. So they just, you know, was very much a Field of Dreams scenario of if you build it, they will come. Basically, you know, rebuilt the dune ecosystem, created kind of a back barrier dune.
What were you aerial seeding?
I think mostly Spartina. Spartina.
Swamp grass.
Yeah. So alterniflora and Peyton's, the backbone of salt marsh vegetation.
So this is looking at an ecosystem, trying to restore it, but also trying to build resiliency in the ecosystem for what we know is coming in these increasing storms and these climate change impacts. So can you talk about how you're seeing kind of the ecosystem coming back, and also, you know, has there been a storm since Sandy, and has this restoration actually helped maybe with some of the flooding or?
Mm-hmm. So I will say that I don't think we've had a storm on that level, certainly, right, since Sandy. We've had, you know, a few pretty intense storms, and, you know, it's more the nor'easters that tend to be in the wintertime that tend to do the most damage to the coastline. I mean, hurricanes can as well, but they're usually so few and far between, whereas nor'easters are, you know, generally a regular event. Common. And I will say that since the restoration happened, there was a road, Prime Hook Beach Road, that used to flood constantly before the restoration and the fixing of the breaches. And the community there were rightly very upset about, you know, the getting cut off from the main road and, you know, upset about the flooding that would happen there. And I will say that since the restoration, that road has not flooded. You know, we haven't had a super intense storm that, like I said, of the level of Sandy or of a hurricane that's really challenged the area. But, you know, the nor'easters that have come, things have been, you know, really holding together. And it's really a good, you know, model of a way that restoration could be done along the coastline. But it's also one of those things that we recognize, like, this is a dynamic place and the coastline is changing. You know, at Bombay Hook, we've lost 2,000 acres of marsh in the last 40 years. If you go and look at the time lapse of the satellite photography on Google Earth, it's really upsetting.
And that sea level rise?
You know, there are some areas that are always, you know, more susceptible to erosion and change. But I think in this particular area, you know, it seems like it's a little bit more related to those kinds of things, to sea level rise and climate change. But we still have everyday things that we're kind of facing. And how do we manage for climate change in the existing environment? So one of the things that we're trying to do in that regard is look at places where, you know, there might be a salt marsh migration where we could facilitate that. In the service, we do something called, there's something called the RAD framework, or resist, accept, direct. And that's our approach to climate change. Like, there'll be some situations where we might resist what's happening and try and continue to, you know, fortify an area, or, you know, like, for example, like here at Bombay Hook, our impoundments are separated from the salt marsh by a dike. We are, you know, trying to do things where we're building up the marsh next to the impoundments so that it, you know, hopefully will be able to resist any, you know, incoming loss or wave, you know, wave energy and things like that. Except is where you kind of look at, okay, there's going to be some things that we're going to lose and we're not going to be able to get them back. And, you know, how do we plan for that? You know, out in the Pacific, looking at some of that, like, there's going to be some islands that, you know, they may be around for a long time. And there's going to be some islands, you know, French Frigate Shoals is constantly losing land. So, you know, one of the things they're doing there is translocating things like Tristram storm petrels and bringing them to Oahu and imprinting them there so that they come back and nest in a predator-proof enclosure on Oahu. And so, you know, you're not losing that species. And then there's direct, and that's where you look at, okay, we know what's coming. How can we do things now to try and better position ourselves for the future? So that's one of the things we're doing in Prime Hook and Bombay Hook is looking at, okay, where are areas that we see that the salt marsh can move to?
And obviously the piping plovers were delighted with the restoration, as I'm sure the horseshoe crabs are ignoring it. They've been around 400 million years and what are we? But the red knots are feeding again on their eggs. The other animal in that range, though, is the human animal. And I'm wondering how the folks at the village of Prime Hook responded to this during this 10-year restoration, and if their attitudes changed, and how the service dealt with the local community interests. Because, you know, with 40% of our population on the shoreline, these are the issues that will help determine how we adapt.
Oh, absolutely. I always like to say that refuge management is about people, that the wildlife in and of themselves usually can pretty much take care of themselves and don't need us as much as we think they do. You know, it's more when we've had direct impacts on them, you know, we obviously need to do things to intervene and help. But yeah, I would say that the overall community feelings that I've encountered, it's definitely a lot more positive than it had been during the times of the breaching and, you know, the early 2000s when the storms were coming in and the breaches were happening. And, you know, the one of my colleagues, Susan Gutierrez, who's our biologist, talks about how, you know, everybody used to have these signs of like, you know, stop the flooding, you know, close the breaches. And, you know, there'd be signs just everywhere about that. And then after the restoration, someone added thank you at the bottom of one of those signs.
We've been using a lot of different terms, wild refuges, national monuments. Can you just explain the difference between some of these federal protections that we have, national parks? How is a national park different than a wildlife refuge?
That's a great question. We're sister agencies. We're both under the Secretary of the Interior, but national parks usually has a different mandate from refuges. We'd like to say that national wildlife refuges are where wildlife comes first. So there are certain things that we will do that you may not see happen at a national park in order to benefit wildlife and wildlife habitat. You know, visitors are definitely a big component of national wildlife refuges, but they're not the primary component. Wildlife is. So one of the things that we do, you know, we close our beach at Fowler Beach on Prime Hook for during the plover nesting season. So you might not see something like that on Assateague National Seashore, which is a National Park Service site. But we have very similar goals and similar missions. We're just, you know, it gets executed a little bit differently. Park Service usually too has more of a historic mandate. There's a lot of historical national parks. So we're complementary. Right. I will say the refuge system has more land than the national parks.
Ah.
You know, a lot of times people think that the national parks are bigger, but they're not. I mean,
oh, sure. But you've got Papahanaumokuakea. That kind of throws the balance off.
Well, you know, just because it, you know, could stretch from Texas to California.
Right. But that's just a little drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
And
when it comes to the ocean, it is.
Right. And that leads me to my next question, which is, you know, on a global level, we've been talking about 30 by 30, protecting 30% of our land and sea by 2030. Obviously, mm-hmm. the wild refuges and the parks and all of these are part of that system. How are you working at this local level, kind of in terms of looking at this bigger global initiative that we're trying to achieve?
Yeah. So when I look at it locally, one of the big things, again, I'm looking at is where would we have space to potentially expand in light of climate change? Every refuge has what's called an acquisition boundary, which basically it's like, this is the area out to which we can buy land. And some refuges like Bombay Hook, we have a lot of acquisition boundary that we haven't necessarily bought land in, but we could expand into. Whereas, you know, Prime Hook is kind of at its acquisition boundary. So you know, it's something that we need to think about a little bit more. Okay, you know, how can we be a little bit more strategic with this?
Well, I just have a question about two visitors to your site, and I'm not equating one with the other at all, but one, you have an annual horseshoe crab phenomena, which I've seen, which is incredible. And maybe you could talk about that. And two, Delaware is also President Biden's home. Has he been to your refuges?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if he's been to the refuges since he's been the president or the vice president, but I do know when he was a senator from the state of Delaware that he was, you know, definitely somebody that communicated with the refuges and the folks that were here, and haven't come across any pictures yet, but that doesn't mean they're not out there. But he does obviously, you know, go past Prime Hook every time he comes down, well, unless he's in, you know, Marine Force One or something like that. But, you know, Rehoboth is just south of Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge. And the horseshoe crabs, so that's one of my absolute favorite animals on this planet, and was so excited when I came to Delaware. I said I was trading in coconut crabs for horseshoe crabs, and red-tailed tropic birds for red knots. But, you know, horseshoe crabs, just as a species, you know, like you said earlier, you know, 450 million years old, they're older than trees and virtually unchanged. The spawning that happens in the Delaware Bay is truly a massive phenomenon to have them come out along the shores of Delaware and New Jersey and do this massive spawning and lay their eggs, which then become a critical fuel for migratory birds like the red knot. But yeah, and I mean, horseshoe crabs are incredibly important for people too, and that their blood is used to test things like vaccines and medications for presence of bacteria, and you know, they help us out as well. And they're really a truly fantastic species.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Kate Toniolo, for joining us today on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. It was a pleasure to talk about your experience from horseshoe crabs to Hawaii. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rising Tide, the Ocean podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helbard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.